It was in September of the year 1811 that a post chaise drew up before the door of Aswerby Hall in the heart of Lincolnshire. The little boy, who was the only passenger in the chaise and who jumped out as soon as it had stopped, looked about him with the keenest curiosity. The post chaise had brought him from Warwickshire, where, some 6 months before, he had been left an orphan. Now, owing to the generous offer of his elderly cousin Mr. Abney, he'd come to live at Aswerby. Very little was known of Mr. Abney's pursuits or temper. The professor of Greek at Cambridge had been heard to say that no one knew more of the religious beliefs of the later pagans than did the owner of Aswerby. He was looked upon as a man wrapped up in his books, and it was a matter of great surprise among his neighbours that he should ever have heard of his orphan cousin Stephen Elliot, much more that he should have volunteered to make him an inmate of Aswerby Hall. Mr. Abney seemed inclined to give his young cousin a kindly reception. The moment the front door was opened, he darted out of his study, rubbing his hands with delight. "How are you, my boy? How old are you?" said he. "That is, you are not too much tired, I hope, by your journey to eat your supper?"
"No, thank you, sir," said Master Elliot. "I'm pretty well."
"And how old are you, my boy?"
It seemed a little odd that he should have asked the question twice in the first 2 minutes of their acquaintance.
"I'm 12 years old next birthday, sir." "Well, well. Take him to Mrs. Bunch's room, Parks, and let him have his tea, supper, whatever it is."
"Yes, sir," answered the staid Mr. Parks, and conducted Stephen downstairs.
Mrs. Bunch made him completely at home. They were great friends in a quarter of an hour, and great friends they remained. One evening Stephen was sitting by the fire in the housekeeper's room, reflecting on his surroundings. "Is Mr. Abney a good man, and will he go to heaven?" he suddenly asked.
"Good," said Mrs. Bunch. "Master's as kind a soul as ever I see. Didn't I never tell you of the little boy as he took in out of the street this 7 years back? And the little girl 2 years after I first come here?"
"No, do tell me all about them, Mrs. Bunch."
"Well," said Mrs. Bunch, "the little girl Master brought back with him from his walk one day, and give orders that she should be took every care with, and the poor child hadn't no one belonging to her. And here she lived with us a matter of 3 weeks, and then one morning she was out of her bed afore any of us had opened an eye, and neither track nor yet trace of her have I set eyes on since."
"Master was wonderful put about, and had all the ponds dragged. But it's my belief she was had away by the gypsies, for there was singing round the house for as much as an hour the night she went."
"And what about the little boy?"
"He were foreign. Giovanni, he called hisself. And he come about the drive one winter day, and Master asked all about where he came from as kind as heart could wish. But he was off one fine morning just the same as the girl."
That night Stephen had a curious dream. At the end of the passage at the top of the house, there was an old disused bathroom. It was kept locked, but Stephen Elliot found himself, as he thought, looking through the glazed door. The moon was shining through the window, and he was gazing at a figure which lay in the bath. The figure was inexpressibly thin and pathetic, of a dusty leaden colour, enveloped in a shroud-like garment, the thin lips crooked into a faint and dreadful smile, the hands pressed tightly over the region of the heart. As he looked upon it, a distant, almost inaudible moan seemed to issue from its lips, and the arms began to stir. The terror of the sight forced Stephen backwards, and he awoke to the fact that he was indeed standing on the cold, boarded floor of the passage. With a courage which I do not think can be common among boys of his age, he went to the door of the bathroom to ascertain if the figure of his dreams were really there. It was not. and he went back to bed. The spring equinox was approaching, as Mr. Abney frequently reminded his cousin, adding that this had been always considered by the ancients to be a critical time for the young. That Stephen would do well to shut his bedroom window at night. At about this time, Stephen had an unusually uneasy and oppressed night, though he could not recall any particular dream that he'd had. The following evening, Mrs. Bunch was occupying herself in mending his nightgown. "Gracious me, Master Stephen," she broke forth rather irritably, "how do you manage to tear your nightdress all to flinders this way?" There was indeed a most destructive and apparently wanton series of slits or scorings in the garment, confined to the left side of the chest. Stephen could only express his entire ignorance of their origin. He was sure they were not there the night before. "But," he said, "Mrs. Bunch, they are just the same as the scratches on the outside of my bedroom door, and I'm sure I never had anything to do with making them." Mrs. Bunch gazed at him open-mouthed, then snatched up a candle, departed hastily from the room, and was heard making her way upstairs. In a few minutes she came down. "Well," she said, "Master Stephen, it's a funny thing to me how them marks and scratches can have come there. Too high up for any cat or dog to have made them, and much less a rat." "I wouldn't say nothing to Master. Just turn the key of the door when you go to bed." March 24, 1812, was a windy, noisy day, which filled the house and the gardens with a restless impression. After luncheon, Mr. Abney said, "Stephen, my boy, do you think you could manage to come to me tonight as late as 11 o'clock in my study? I shall be busy until that time, and I wish to show you something connected with your future life, which it is most important that you should know. You are not to mention this matter to anyone, and you had better go to your room at the usual time." Stephen looked in at the library door on his way upstairs that evening, and saw a brazier moved out before the fire. An old silver-gilt cup stood on the table, filled with red wine, and some written sheets of paper lay near it. Mr. Abney was sprinkling some incense on the brazier from a round silver box as Stephen passed, but did not seem to notice his step. The wind had fallen, and there was a still night and a full moon. At about 10 o'clock, Stephen was standing at the open window of his bedroom, looking out over the country. From time to time, strange cries, as of lost and despairing wanderers, sounded from across the mere. They might be the notes of owls or water birds, yet they did not quite resemble either sound. Were they not coming nearer? Then they ceased. But Stephen caught sight of two figures standing on the gravel terrace that ran along the garden side of the hall. The figures of a boy and girl, as it seemed. They stood side by side, looking up at the windows. Something in the form of the girl recalled irresistibly his dream of the figure in the bath. The boy inspired him with more acute fear. Whilst the girl stood still, half smiling, with her hands clasped over her heart, the boy, a thin shape, with black hair and ragged clothing, raised his arms in the air with an appearance of menace and of unappeasable hunger and longing. The moon shone upon his almost transparent hands, and Stephen saw that the nails were fearfully long and that the light shone through them. On the left side of his chest, there opened a black and gaping rent. In another moment, this dreadful pair had moved swiftly and noiselessly over the dry gravel, and he saw them no more. Inexpressibly frightened as he was, he determined to go down to Mr. Abney's study, for the hour appointed for their meeting was near at hand. But his repeated knocks produced no answer. Mr. Abney was engaged. He was speaking. What? Why did he try to cry out? And why was the cry choked in his throat? Had he, too, seen the mysterious children? But now everything was quiet, and the door yielded to Stephen's terrified and frantic pushing. On the table in Mr. Abney's study, certain papers were found which explained the situation to Stephen Elliott when he was of an age to understand them. The most important sentences were as follows. It was a belief very strongly held by the ancients that by absorbing the personalities of a certain number of his fellow creatures, an individual may gain ascendancy over those spiritual beings which control the elemental forces of our universe. I find it set down in the writings of Hermes Trismegistus that results may be produced by the absorption of the hearts of not less than 3 human beings below the age of 12 years. To the testing of the truth of this receipt, I have devoted the greater part of the last 20 years, selecting as the corpora vilia of my experiment such persons as could conveniently be removed without occasioning a sensible gap in society. The first step I effected by the removal of one Phoebe Stanley on March the 24th, 1792. The second, by the removal of a wandering Italian lad named Giovanni Paoli on the night of March the 23rd, 1805. The final victim, to employ a word repugnant in the highest degree to my feelings, must be my cousin Stephen Elliott. His day must be this March the 24th, 1812. The best means of effecting the required absorption is to remove the heart from the living subject, to reduce it to ashes, and to mingle them with about a pint of some red wine, preferably port. The remains of the first 2 subjects, at least, it will be well to conceal. A disused bathroom or wine cellar will be found convenient for such a purpose. Some annoyance may be experienced from the psychic portion of the subjects, which popular language dignifies with the name of ghosts. But the man of philosophic temperament will be little prone to attach importance to the feeble efforts of these beings to wreak their vengeance on him. The experiment, if successful, will not only place me beyond the reach of human justice, so-called, but eliminate to a great extent the prospect of death itself. Mr. Abney was found in his chair, his head thrown back, his face stamped with an expression of rage, fright, and mortal pain. In his left side was a terrible lacerated wound, exposing the heart. There was no blood on his hands. The window of the study was open, and it was the opinion of the coroner that Mr. Abney had met his death by the agency of some wild creature. But Stephen Elliott's study of the papers I have quoted led him to a very different conclusion.